You know, on this program over the years, we've talked about consciousness, spirituality, the psychic connection. Tonight with Dr. Stephen Schwartz, we'll chat with him about that and much more next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Always great to have Stephen Schwartz on the program, distinguished consulting faculty of Saybrook University, a research associate of the Cognitive Sciences Laboratory of the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. That's a mouthful. He's a columnist for the journal Explore and an all-round good guy. His latest book, The 8 Laws of Change, How to Be an Agent of Personal and Social Transformation. Stephen, you never stop working, do you?
No, George, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
You too. What's new besides all these other things you've been doing?
Well, I really have been focused on, for the last couple of years, I did about 16 years worth of research on how individuals and small groups can cause change. Four times in my life I've been involved with changing history, and I got very interested in how the process works. And given this election that we're now in, I thought it would be important to put out the results of the research so that individuals and small groups could actually put it to work.
All right. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, when I looked at it, I thought if you wanted to create social change, you started with things like how do you collect money, you know, how do you raise money, and how do you set up organizations and those kinds of things. But as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that the data was telling me something quite different. It was really saying to me that what matters is the nature of your character more than anything else, and that that the need to get control of and understand the real power of the individual to create change was not something that had to do with money or politics. It had to do with things like the individuals individually and the group collectively had to share a common intention. Now, you wouldn't think of that, but if you think about, if you've ever been on a school committee or a church committee or, you know, something, you know how hard it is to get everybody on the same page. Well, it turns out if you want to create social transformation, that's one of the things you have to learn. But what I learned also from this is that nonviolent change succeeds about 75% of the time. I looked at something over 200 social transformations from 1906 to 1914 all over the world. And I read a lot of research that had been done by other people. I mean, there's quite a lot actually in the literature on this. And I discovered that, as I say, nonviolent change succeeds about 75% of the time, and violent change only succeeds about 25% of the time, and it doesn't last very long. And if you think about that, you know, why would that be true? And the answer, of course, is that violent change creates enemies and makes people angry and scared and resentful, whereas nonviolent change is inclusive and gets people's hearts engaged, and so they hang together much better and things last longer. So as I went through this research, I thought this is something that just regular people, that was the issue for me. How do people who don't have an official position, who don't have vast wealth, who don't have armies at their command, how do they create social, first of all, can they create social change, and then how do they do it?
Peacefully, too, right?
Yes, and peacefully turns out to be the way to do it, and it also turns out that small groups of individuals, the most particular group was the Quakers. Now, most people have never met a Quaker. They're less than 87,000 people who consider themselves Quakers.
Richard Nixon was a Quaker, wasn't he? I do believe he was.
Well, he did. That's true. He started out as a Quaker.
Yep.
I don't know that the Quakers would claim him. He started out.
He was one. That's right.
But in any case, there are only about 87,000 people in a country of 317 million who are Quakers. There have been less than 500,000, less than a million for sure, in the whole of American history going back to colonial times. And yet, if you look at almost every major social transformation that's socially progressive that happened in the United States, abolition of slavery, public education, penal reform, women's suffrage, nuclear freeze, the environmental movement, what you find is it started out with a small group of Quakers. And so I began to look at how these little groups like the Quakers are able to achieve these enormous changes. Almost, they do it almost anonymously. And as I studied it, I realized that there were 8 laws that came out that you had to learn. Now, I didn't invent them. The data brought them out. So that if you looked at the successful changes as opposed to the unsuccessful ones, you saw that these same 8 laws came up again and again and again and again. They all the successful movements figure out a way to work them out. They discover them for themselves. And I can give you the 8 laws if you'd like.
Yeah, rattle through them, and then we'll go through them later during the show.
Law number 1, the individuals individually and the group collectively must share a common intention. I already mentioned that one.
Okay.
Law number 2, the individuals and the group must have goals, but they may not have cherished outcomes. I learned this from the abolitionists. Law number 3, the individuals in the group must accept that the goal may not be reached in their lifetimes and be okay with this. And I learned this from suffragettes and from the abolitionists.
The Chinese practice that a lot.
Yes, absolutely. That's why they've been at it for a long, long time. Law number 4, the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get either credit or acknowledgement for what they have done and be okay about this. Law number 5, each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality even as the various roles in the hierarchy of the effort are respected. This is where a lot of groups break down. They try to, they want to make everybody equal, which is fundamental, but, you know, we're high-order primates. We organize in hierarchies, and so even as you recognize fundamental equality, that's what the founders were driving at in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, that there's fundamental equality, but there are still, the nature of how humans operate is hierarchical. Law number 5, each person in the group, regardless of gender, race, or culture must... Oh, I already did that.
That was 5.
Yeah.
5 was equality.
Yes. Number 6, the individuals in the group must forswear violence in word, act, or thought. That's a hard one.
Sounds like Gandhi.
Yes. Well, in fact, we can get back to that. Yes.
Okay.
Remind me of Gandhi in a minute.
I shall.
Law number 7, the individuals in the group and the group itself must make their private selves consistent with their public postures. I mean, we all know...
That's not easy.
Yeah, not easy. And we can all remember people who have put themselves up as spiritual leaders or political leaders, and their private life is...
Whoa.
Different. Yes. And law number 8... The individuals in the group and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of life-affirming integrity.
Now, must you do all 8 in order to make change? Or can you do 6 of them?
You can. Let me put it this way. That is a very good question, George. The answer is, I think, that to the degree that you work all 8 out, you will be more successful. You can be partially successful doing only some of them.
Have you found in your research that successful people who've created change, and we've had a lot of them over, you know, our course of our history, practiced many of these, whether they were intentional or not?
Absolutely. In fact, I got started in this because, you know, in addition to being a consciousness researcher, I also have a life as a historian of the early American Republic.
That's right.
And what got me really started from this, I'm in my own experience, as I said, 4 times I'd been involved in changing history. But as I began to do this research, the person who really caught my attention was Benjamin Franklin.
Really? How come?
Well, because, for instance, I mean, nobody knows this, but micro-lending, you know, micro-lending, the Grameen Bank and all that.
Uh-huh.
Benjamin Franklin invented micro-lending, and he used it to create the American middle class.
Well, that was smart.
And in fact, as you and I are talking here tonight, there are hundreds of kids who are getting an education based on Benjamin Franklin's money. He left a bequest to both Boston and Philadelphia creating this micro-lending scheme and saying that a part of the money must be used to make the city amenable to people so that they enjoyed it, for parks and sanitation and hospitals and fire departments. And the other part of the money was to be loaned at low interest to, not given away, loaned at low interest to what he called young married artificers, that young men who were craftsmen, people that did machinists and carpentry and things like that. Because his vision of America was that it was going to be a middle class, upwardly mobile, technologically sophisticated, family-centered, sort of fun-loving country in which immigrants were a critical part because everybody was an immigrant. So he did everything he could both in his lifetime. He started the first fire department. He started the first hospital. He started sanitation. He was concerned about water, pure water. He wanted money to go into parks and public baths. And when he came back, I mean, he's the only man who signed all three of the foundation documents that created the United States, the Treaty of Versailles, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution. He's the only one signed all of them.
Was he a genius? Do you have to be a genius to pull this off?
You're you're in great form tonight, George. yes, that was the question I had, is do you have to be a genius? And the answer to the question is you do not. In fact,
thank God,
ago,
there's hope for me yet.
Or both of us. some years ago, I went out to dinner with Richard Feynman, a Nobel laureate physicist, one of the great physicists of the last half of the 20th century. And he told me this story. He said he really wanted to be a great physicist when he was in school. And so one night he broke into the administration office and he got his file and he looked in his file and he'd done this IQ test. And he discovered that his IQ was 124, which is pretty good. 100 is the norm, the world norm. And 124 is pretty good, but he said, I just couldn't believe that anybody with 124 IQ was going to become a world historical physicist. And yet, of course, he did. And so the answer is, IQ may be useful, but no, IQ is not a critical component of this.
Now, when you looked at the eight laws of change, what is your definition of change?
Well, the change that I have focused on is the creation of wellness. I don't know about anybody else or you, but my view is that the function of the state is to produce well-being for everybody.
Would be nice.
And well,
in a perfect
can be done,
world.
And in fact is being done in some countries. So that's what I think the whole function of the state is. I mean, protecting people, that's part of being well-being, but also education, child care, elder care, all those things, those are all productive of well-being.
If a presidential candidate followed these eight laws of change, would they be a successful president?
Yes. Yes, they would be wildly successful.
Yeah.
Because every time we have a president who does that, we have enormous success. I mean, you look at Franklin Roosevelt and the creation of the American middle class.
All right. Well, let's go through some of these.
Okay.
All right. Intention. What do you mean by that?
Well, intention is that you are holding that you have a commitment to achieve a certain purpose. That you have you hold intention that something is going to happen. The key is, though,
almost like you visualize it.
Yes, that may be part of it. It might be that you take it into meditation. That would be part of it. But the key to it is that when you are presented with a decision And we do this hundreds of times every day. You know, you go into the supermarket and you buy a tube of toothpaste, or you buy some breakfast cereal. You know, I mean, do you really think about, you know, what is this company? Do these people, does this company pay their employees well? Are they polluters? Most people never think about that. What this is trying to tell us, I think, is that these little daily choices, quotidian choices, that we make almost without thinking all day long, that we need to become aware first that we're making a choice, and that of the options that are available to us, that we consistently choose the one that is the most compassionate and life-affirming. And when that happens in the aggregate, then you have social change. And that's how it happens. I mean, I can give you a specific example. Look at the difference. It took about 18 months for gay to become LGBT, which was not just a change in a word, gay to LGBT, but also an entire change in how we consider gender.
And who came up with that?
Came up with what?
The change.
Everybody did. That's the point. The president didn't go on television and say, now we're going to say LGBT. No court ruled on it. What happened was, and you can look at the Google word count and see it actually happen, is that when people were writing in emails or tweets or whatever, that where they would have used the word gay, they used LGBT.
Well, you know what? The same thing in a stranger way, Stephen. I started hearing a word called selfie. You know what that is, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. Because of the advent of the smartphones, you would start hearing these words, selfie. And I got to tell you, in the beginning, I didn't know. My granddaughter knew what it was. I didn't. And I asked her, I said, what is this selfie? I'm hearing selfie all over the place all of a sudden. And she went and explained it to me. That, you know, that's the art of taking pictures of yourself with your smartphone.
Yep.
But I mean, that like happened at a certain point and then ran like wildfire.
Exactly.
All over the place.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things about the internet is that it has made it possible for these shifts in gestalt, or these shifts in consciousness, these are changes in consciousness, to sweep across the world. And nobody passes a law about it. Nobody says it all, you know, there's no edict that's issued. It's just that people like your granddaughter adopt it, think about it, begin to put it into use, and all of a sudden it becomes a major thing in the culture.
Yeah, it really does. The other area, of course, number two, goals. Of course, that's obvious, right?
Yes, but it's not as obvious as you would think, because if you look at how changes occur, what you see is a lot of groups that try to create change, they have a very particular way they want that change to happen. And so they really only accept it if it works out the way they want it to work. So that's why the second law is you can have a goal. For instance, the abolitionists, let me use them as an example. If you go back and read their letters and their diaries and contemporaneous accounts and things like that, what you see over and over again is people saying slavery is a moral evil and it must end. And I don't know how that's going to happen, but I'm going to do everything in my capability day by day to do what I can to make slavery end. And I don't know how it's going to happen, but I am committed to its happening.
Stay with us, Stephen. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back and talk more about the rest of the eight laws of change. It's kind of interesting. It really is. I think we should mail it to Hillary and Donald and to the Libertarian and the Green Party folks, Jill Stein, and maybe they can use it. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Stephen Schwartz with us. We're talking about his latest work, The Eight Laws of Change. We're getting into those laws right now. We were talking about goals, Stephen. If you want to finish that one up, then we'll go to number three.
Well, the point of the goal thing was that what you get when you look at people who have been successful at this is that they have goals, but they don't have cherished outcomes. That is, they want something to happen, but they don't demand that it happen in a certain way. And the reason that I think that's very important is that underlying all of this, George, is the fact that this presumes that all life is interconnected and interdependent. You know, we were talking earlier before the break about your granddaughter and selfies.
Yeah.
This connection that's going on is not just a connection at the intellectual level, but there's also this non-local aspect of consciousness, this sort of mass consciousness, what Jung called the collective unconscious, what Adolf Bastian called the elementary thoughts of humanity. So if you can tap into that, then you can begin to create these changes. And other people have ways they would like things to work out. So you're in conflict if each of you has a different cherished outcome. But if you just have a common goal, then it works much better.
Your next one, number three, is not to be reached in your lifetime. I guess you're talking about a specific change, but it doesn't happen in your lifetime. You die, but it still happens later on. Is that what you mean?
I got this from the abolitionists, because they would say in their diaries, you know, these are in the 18th century, slavery is a moral evil, and it must end. And I don't know whether it's going to happen in my lifetime, but all I can say is that I'm going to spend my lifetime working to achieve it.
Most people, Stephen, they'll want it like right now.
Yes, of course. I didn't say these eight laws were easy, because we have a lot of attitudes about them, but I'm saying that if you want to be successful, if you want to create massive social change, and you can do it, you must adhere to these eight laws. And I say that not because it's my personal opinion, but because if you do the analysis of the successful changes, you see that these same eight principles are a part of every successful effort.
All right, next one is no credit or acknowledgement. Basically, that's what? Ego?
Well, that is that you do the work, and you're doing the work not in order to get glory for yourself, but because you believe that the whatever it is you're working for is fundamentally correct. I mean, I'll tell you a very quick story about a man who won the Nobel Prize and never told anybody. I was working with an English chemist named Douglas Dean, and he was older than I was, and one day I said to him, "Doug, you know, you're a Quaker. What did you do?" He was an Englishman. "What did you do in Britain during the war? It must have been very hard to be a conscientious objector." And as a Quaker, I assume that's what you were. He said, "Oh, yes, I was." I said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "Well, I was a bomb warden." And I said, "What's a bomb warden?" And he said, "Well, you know, when the bombs were falling, they didn't all blow up. And so a bunch of us would go out in trucks that they gave us, and we would pick up the unexploded bombs so that the firemen could get into the burning buildings and take them out of the burning buildings and take them to a collection point, and they would blow them up." And I said, "That sounds extraordinarily dangerous." And he said, "Well, it was, because sometimes they blew up." And I said, "Well, what did you do after the war?" And he said, "Well, you know, there were all these people wandering around Europe." In those days, they were called displaced persons. There were these millions of people that were wandering around Europe that had been devastated. And so a group of us got together and tried to work on finding them places to live and to make sure they had enough to eat and things like that. And I said, "Douglas, you aren't part of the Society of Friends Committee, the American and British Society of Friends Committee, that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1947, were you?" And he looked down at his shoes and said, "Well, yeah." So a few years later, he died, and I wrote an obit about him, and I began it, "Douglas Dean, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, chemist, and became a consciousness researcher." And the editor of the journal that had asked me to write the obit called me up and said, "I can't publish this." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, because Douglas Dean never won the Nobel Peace Prize. He wasn't a co-recipient." And I said, "Well, I can only tell you what he said." And he said, "Well, I can't publish it unless you can prove it to me."
Confirm
so
it,
I called
sure.
up Oslo, which is where the Nobel Peace
That's
Prize
where
comes
they,
from.
They would know.
And I said to the woman who answered the phone, this was pre-internet, "You know, I want to check this out. Is it true?" And she came back and said, "This is really weird, but these people won the award anonymously. They didn't even come and give the speech that you give when you win the prize. They had the Secretary General read it."
Jeez.
And I said, "Well, I think this man deserves this acknowledgement. Could you ask the Secretary General if he would have any objection to this statement that Douglas Dean? And she said, well, call me back and I will find out. And so I called her back and she said, I am instructed to say to you that if you were to say that Douglas Dean was a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, the committee would find no in error in that. And so this man had won a Nobel Peace Prize and nobody knew it.
Well, how many people, though, really want to get credit for things they do?
Well, I don't know. A lot of people seem to.
Exactly.
But one of the, the thing about the eight laws is that they are all personal disciplines about yourself. They're not about changing other people. They're about changing yourself, really. And when you change yourself, that we talked about Gandhi earlier. Gandhi, just before he was assassinated in 1948, a reporter went up and asked him and said, well, Gandhi, my editor has only one question for you, and that is, how did you force the British to leave India? You have no army, you had no official position, you have no money. I mean, here's Gandhi sitting there in his little dhoti, with his ashram. How did you force one of the most powerful countries in the world that had been here for 300 years and India was the gem of their empire, how did you force them to leave? And Gandhi's answer was, and it makes this point, it wasn't what we did that mattered, although that mattered. It wasn't what we said that mattered, although that mattered. It was the nature of our character which led the British to choose to leave India.
Do you think that would work today? Gandhi's procedure would work today if he was dealing with ISIS?
Well,
they'd kill him.
Gandhi, by the way, nonviolence is, as he said to somebody, when you're being attacked by a lion, it's okay to shoot.
There you go.
I would say to you, Martin Luther King was influenced by Gandhi. And Gandhi, by the way, all of this traces back to Thoreau and Walden Pond and an essay he wrote called Civil Disobedience. That's where Gandhi got the idea for Gandhi. What we call Gandhian policy is not Gandhi's, it's actually Thoreau's, and Gandhi read it when he was a young lawyer, and then Martin Luther King read Gandhi's reading of it, and that's where the idea for the American civil rights movement came from. Three countries were changed because one man sitting in a cabin next to a little pond in the northeastern United States wrote an essay called Civil Disobedience.
All right, number five, equality.
Number five, each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality. Well, this, I think, for instance, is where Occupy broke down, because they never put forward a spokesperson, and so there was no one to coalesce around. Martin Luther King was not the only, I was there. I got arrested a number of times on behalf of civil rights, and heard him give the I Have a Dream speech. And he wasn't the only person. He was, the spokesperson around which it coalesced. And that's because, we're high-order primates, and we coalesce around people. Just look at the election that's going on now. So if you don't, one of the things to have, if you're going to have a successful transformational movement, is you got to have somebody who articulates it. And yet, at the same time, you have to recognize that everyone is fundamentally equal. And just because you may hold a decision-making position in the organization does not make you a superior human being. And that's the difference between elites and organizations which are based on equality.
Next one is no violence. This is an interesting one, Stephen, because
this is the hard one for
this
me.
This is hard because some people, governmental leaders will use violence for change.
Absolutely. But let me tell you another Gandhi story, George.
All right.
Gandhi broke the British, really, broke their resolve with the salt riot, the salt tax. In those days, this is in the late 30s, early 40s, it was illegal to make salt. Now, you'd say, well, all you
That was a commodity, wasn't it?
Yes, all you have to do is go out and get a dish of ocean water and let it dissolve, let it evaporate, and you got salt. But anyway, the making of salt was taxed, very much like the tea tax in the colonial period in America. And so Gandhi trained a group of people, a large number of people, to and he organized what came to be known as the resistance of the salt tax. And the way he did this is that they marched, he trained these people, and I talked to people who were alive and were part of that group when I was doing the research for this book, and they said they trained us, he trained us as if we were soldiers. And eventually the way they did it was that the Indian troops were around the area, and the British officers were behind them, and the Indian troops had these, looked like axe handles, these staves. And 11 people walked forward and were struck to the ground, and the women would drag them away and put first aid on them. And this all happened in silence. Another 11 people would walk forward, and it went on all morning. And then suddenly something happened, and the Indian troops looked at one another, and they lay down their staves and said to their British officers, "We're not doing this anymore."
They were done.
They were done. They looked at what they had done, and they said, "We're not doing this anymore." And that's how the salt tax was broken.
No violence.
There may be violence, and that's what Martin Luther King said on the, on the Birmingham Bridge, is they're going to attack us and they're going to club us, but we're not going to respond. And it went on television, and everybody saw it. You saw it. I saw it. Millions of Americans saw it, and that was it.
What do you mean by private self, number seven?
Number seven, the private self. Well, if you set yourself up as a moral authority, you're a spiritual leader. I mean, I don't want to name any names, but we can all think of them. If you set yourself up as some kind of an authority and your private life and your public life are different, you create, again, this invokes this idea of this, all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent. All of your followers are focusing their intention and their awareness on the public persona that you put forward. But if your public persona and your private self are in dissonance, it creates an impossible situation, and you implode, as so many people like this do. You get caught in a motel with a prostitute, or you get caught in a drug deal, or whatever. You're not straight about money. So in order to do this, you have to be authentically what you're claiming to be. And that's the key to it. It's this nature of one's character, one's beingness.
Last, integrity.
Yes. Well, you
probably is, my favorite.
Yes. This is essentially what I said earlier about these quotidian choices. Every day you make dozens of choices. If you will look at the first of all, be aware you're making a choice, and second of all, look at the options that you have available to you, and consistently always choose the compassionate and life-affirming option of those that are available to you, and you consistently do this. I will, here, right here, you and I, right here tonight, we can set in motion a social change. You have a huge audience. I mean, this is the largest radio programs in America. Or the world, I guess.
Yes.
But in any case, it's...
Maybe the universe, Stephen.
Well, in any case, we're talking about a lot of people, right? Okay, here it is. If all the people that will listen to this, who are listening to this program, will make this commitment, I will become aware that I am making a choice day by day. All these little choices I make, things I buy, things I do, I will always consistently choose the one that is the most compassionate and life-affirming of the options that are available to me as I understand it in this moment. I will tell 10 friends that I am doing this as a discipline. I will invite them to join me, and I will ask them to tell 10 of their friends to also join me. Well, you just do the math. You'd start with almost 1 million people, or maybe more. So then you'd have 10 million. Then you'd have 100 million. You can create social change. This is how real, lasting social change actually happens. It's not political. It's not about money. Look at smoking, for instance. When you and I were boys, you went to somebody's house, and on the coffee table there was an ashtray and one of those Ronson lighters and a pack of cigarettes.
I never smoked, though.
Well, I know, but nonetheless, the culture did. Right?
Yeah.
We don't do this anymore.
Nope. Things are changing.
That's right. Why? Nobody passed a law that said you can't smoke. What happened was they put out information and people said, oh, well, in that case, I'm not going to smoke. I don't smoke either. But it happened because individuals made choices.
If you use these laws in your everyday life,
yep,
not just business, but in your everyday life, a relationship, anything,
yep,
will that change you?
Yes. Yes, it will absolutely change you. I mean, it will not only create change, but it will fundamentally change you. I guarantee it. Absolutely comes with a guarantee. If you will do this quotidian choice thing about making these choices like this, you will be a different person in a very short space of time, because it will change the whole way you look at the world.
Can you make these changes very subtly?
Yes. Well, they are subtle. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah.
You think, I'm just an ordinary citizen. What can I do? Well, you know, I go into buy a school notebook. Do I buy the notebook that's made by the company that pollutes, or do I buy the notebook made by the company that's using recycled paper? It's that kind of thing.
Well, you talk about no credit or acknowledgement. Years ago, when I was a public relations executive, we had a company president who loved to come in early. I did not. I loved to stay late. Big difference.
Too.
But there was a guy in the office. So our president would get in about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
There was a guy in the office who would come in at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And so there was only two of them in the building, him and the president.
Right.
We had an office that looked like a square in the hallway. You could walk all the way around and come back to where you started. It was that kind of an office, right? And he would walk around until the president saw him walking. Sometimes it would be four times, all the way around in a square. Finally, on one of the walks, the president came out of his office. This is 6 o'clock in the morning. He tells us this story. And he said to the kid, how many times are you going to walk around? he saw it the first time. And, there's somebody who has violated clause number four in your laws of change. We're going to come back and not only take questions with Stephen Schwartz, but how about your stories on how maybe you've applied yourself to some of these things? This is one of those feel-good nights. We'll be back.